So today we are going to be talking about how to be a good guest. But we're probably going to take a roundabout way to get there, which is fitting because I have a podcast called Inefficiency. And the premise of the show is that we explore our deathbed desires, the things that matter most to us at the end of our lives, namely our relationships, our convictions, and our faith. So when I come up here, I make an assumption about all of you, for better and for worse, which is that you guys care deeply, that you feel deeply, and that you have an intense compassion and a desire to live it out in meaningful ways. But we don't know always how to live it out. We need some parameters. We need some guidance. So my question to begin our time with is, to whom do you direct your compassion? And how do you get in your own way when trying to live out that compassion? So I sat on the idea of a podcast, which, by the way, this is David Salinas's work. Got to have a shout out to him. But I sat on the idea of a podcast for way too long. I've always felt like the therapy hour, I'm a therapist, by the way, the therapy hour is an inefficient time. People often come to see me in the middle of the day. They pay good money to talk about their pain, which, and there isn't a guarantee, right? They explore without a guarantee of arriving at a specific place. They express and they risk without the guarantee of improvement. But yet they come. It's inefficient. And what they normally find is health. They find insight. They find relief. And I wanted to be able to expand out this idea of inefficiency and maybe give a second hour to people to engage in the sacred inefficiencies of life. But as much as my compassion wanted to drive me there, I also had fear and ego, and so I stalled out for quite a while. I was terrified of looking lame, to be quite honest. I felt like it needed to be the perfect representation of me, and I was terrified I would be overwhelmed by the whole thing. And it wasn't until some dear friends of mine helped me reframe this to that it can be simple. We can start small. And that you have a lot of freedom to be as lame as you need to be. It wasn't until then that I felt the pressure was off of me and that my compassion could breathe and I could find some freedom in it. Compassion is defined as a sympathetic consciousness of others' distress and a desire to alleviate it. So there's a difference between sympathy and compassion, right? So you see a wounded dog, a puppy on the side of the road, and you're like, "Aw, puppy." That's sympathy, right? If you say, "Aw, puppy, let's take him in and wash him, and like he'll be in our bed forever, and we'll like, cool," right? That's compassion. There's a desire to not only feel something for it, but want to do something about it. And today we're going to be looking at a section of scripture where Jesus, it says that Jesus' heart broke. He had compassion on the people. They were lost and they were confused and he wanted to do something about it. And so he healed the sick. He touched the untouchables. He connected with people in their condition. And I think there's something in that for us when we start to look at how we want to live out compassion. And so what we're going to be reading together as a community out loud is a charge that he's giving the 12 disciples to go out and do the same thing. And it's not just a question of what to do, but a question of how to do it. So as is our custom, let's read together Matthew 10, 5 through 16. And this is the Message version. So what we see here is that Jesus is giving some guidelines to his disciples to help ground them as they go out and try to make disciples, something that Jenna talked about last week. But this is to kind of keep them on the rails, like, right, just the possibility that their love and their compassion can really connect with people. So let's break this down a little bit more. So it says, you don't need a lot of equipment. You are the equipment. And all you need to keep going is 3 meals a day. Travel light. So I love this. The first thing I think about in this text is two quotes from two radically different men. But I think the wisdom is all the same. So the first person I'm thinking about is Biggie Smalls. Mo money, mo problems. And side note, that album, Life After Death, came out 20 years ago this week. And it came out after his death, Life After Death. Him and Tupac. But we can make things into a big production. We can grow our problems, and we will start to lose our original intention. And then I think of the other person, the poet Wendell Berry. And he says this, don't own so much clutter that you'll be relieved to see your house catch fire. Isn't that good? That's so good. We can overcomplicate things with how much we own and with how much we owe. So the idea of keeping it simple and modest holds some water. But I'm also interested not just in the physical sense of traveling lightly, but the emotional and relational perspectives of traveling lightly. Because anything that we do, like, imagine how many overpackers do we have in here? Like, you go on a trip. Yeah. Lying. So a lot of, for some of us, maybe it's just habit, but this physical act of packing in a heavy way probably has some emotional and relational ties underneath it, right? Some of you are anxious people and you think of 1,000 different scenarios. And so you need an outfit for every scenario, right? Some of you hate the feeling of being unprepared, right? And so you pack more. Some of you are visiting people that you're not that close with and you don't want to feel that dependent on them. You don't want to impose on them, right? Like, all of these different things are the motor underneath of some of these physical manifestations of it. So to me, it's really interesting to think about traveling lightly in terms of our emotions and our relationships. There's a sign in the door of musician John Foreman's house that reads, travel lightly and deeply. And there's an idea that we can physically travel lightly, but that doesn't mean that we float on the surface, but rather we're freed up to explore our depths. And as we lean into our compassion, we start to see that we have wounds, we have shame, and we have ego that can hold us back. Compassion led me to seminary to get a counseling degree, and I had no idea what I was doing at all. And the people around me that were doing a kind of therapy that was kind of short-term solution focused. And at times it was almost like a curriculum. You know, it would almost pass out worksheets and homework. And it never really resonated with me, but it did do something to my fear, because as a young student of counseling, I was terrified of getting stuck, of not knowing what to do. And it felt like kind of like this music stand. It would, like, if I could throw a worksheet or a book or a statistic at somebody, like, I could kind of hide behind that and get by. And it wasn't until an adjunct professor took me aside and said, Matt, you have a calming nature. Just bring yourself. You don't have to bring anything else. And if you get stuck, they're probably already stuck. And maybe it's better to be stuck together. And that totally changed my approach. And so I love this line, that you are the equipment. I can't tell you how much that terrified me and also brought peace to me all at the same time. It changed my approach to therapy, but that was kind of when I started to learn how to travel lightly in my personhood. And so as a spiritual practice, you can ask the question, where do you overcomplicate your life and love by carrying around extra equipment? How can you travel lightly? So I wanted to start off this idea of traveling lightly because following God and the compassions he gives us, we're bound to be clumsy in it, and sometimes even forceful. Our love has the ability to heal and also wound. So to move through the rest of the passage, I'd like some help from a sage fellow therapist. Kind of do a little inefficiency style. So if we can welcome up Sam Lee, I'm going to interview him. So as you're getting ready, I'm going to introduce you a little bit. So some of you have known Sam for a long time, him and his wife, Carol, and his family has been staples of this, community for a long time. It was on staff at one point. They moved to Seattle to get an MDiv, moved back to Austin, moved back to Seattle to get a counseling degree. And now he's back in Austin. And he's a therapist in private practice, samleycounseling.com. So check it out. Thank you. Yeah. You wouldn't do that too. I have to do it. We don't have a ton of time, so I'm just going to start throwing fastballs if you don't mind. So the story I just told about grad school, was really about me realizing that I'm enough. Right. And Brené Brown, who's a researcher and author, says that there are two shame triggers that we move through in life. That you are not enough, and who do you think you are? Two things that are just, kind of make you crumble a little bit. So as your compassion and conviction has moved you from pastor to therapist, how have you learned how to travel lightly to shed some of the shame and ego in a different way?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think when you talk about in a context of compassion and conviction, then I feel like it's in the context of what you're called to do, what you're meant to do. And I think I see being a pastor and therapist is kind of in the same realm of you're called to help and be with someone. And so I think in that, the vocation of a pastor and therapist, they're kind of one and the same. I don't see the difference in that. But for me, has been the kind of the self-discovery of like, who I am enough in that? I think I'll share a story that might help kind of give that context. I moved back to Seattle, got a counseling degree, and I saw my first client. So I was like really hyped up,
excited.
Mm. It's like, this is going to be good.
You're going to do so good.
And so there was a part of me that just felt like, I have all this like experience as a pastor. I think I could do this. And then I'm learning and I really want to do well. So I had this client, my first client. He's 17 years old. And was suffering with anxiety, and he was diagnosed with selective mutism, which is a form of anxiety where in certain settings he cannot speak and he becomes mute. He's been in the system. I was working at a mental health agency. He's been in the system for 4 years. No one has been able to get him to speak. And my supervisor had him, and he was like, you couldn't do anything with him. He's like, here, give it to the intern, because he's not client's not in crisis, and we'll see what happens. Well, there's a part of me that's just like, I really want to do something. I want to be the first to get him to really speak. But I think out of that also, there was a heart that I really wanted to connect with him. And so I remember the first few times speaking with him in session, and I would just get a grunt here and there, but really nothing much. And in the course of getting to know him in the first few sessions, I found out from his mother that the only time he speaks ever is when he's playing online games. And when he's playing online games, he's as if he's just a normal person. So then, part of me was just really listening well and just saying, hey, maybe I could play games with him. So over the next 6 months, we started just playing games. And I saw over the course of the 6 months, like, he's just started opening up more. He's laughing, he's talking, but only in the confines of the game. After that, so how's the week going? There wasn't much.
Was that frustrating for you?
Yes, it was. Yeah, yeah. Because I had the agency, because of all the paperwork and all the... I had to show that he was making progress. And he wasn't going to school. He was still suffering. He wasn't really talking. And it wasn't looking like I was making much progress. I had a professor at the time. And then she was saying, no, you're doing great. He invited you in to his world. He invited you into his internal world. It's in the form of the games, but, you know, he's inviting you in. And that was, just stay with that. But then there was a part of me that really wanted him to, like, start talking and then going back to school and everything. And then I started moving outside of that realm. And I remembered my last 3 months there, and knowing that I was going to end there, he wasn't going to go to school. I started to go outside of the game realm and to start, like, hey, you know, I really, really... And so I was trying to care deeply, but in caring outside of the realms of where he allowed me in, he started to retreat more and more. Mm. And so I realized that part of my own ego, part of my own, it was care, but I allowed some of the overexertion of myself to get in the way of actually meeting with him.
Yeah, you didn't really believe that interacting with him at that game level was enough. You had to do something bigger.
Yes.
To prove.
And then that care became more about me.
Yeah.
About what I wanted to feel as a successful therapist.
Yeah. Which, as a young therapist, you needed at some level. Yeah.
Yeah. I needed some of that feedback.
Yeah. Well, and you use the word invited, like he, or I think something like that. Like, say more about what you mean by he invited you into something.
I think, particularly as the therapist, you know, we have like our office space, you know, try to make it inviting. And so in some ways we're hosting, clients to say, hey, this is a safe space that, you know, you can interact about some of the things, that is troubling you. But then the moment the client starts speaking, I think I see myself, then the role, changes. Because then I become a guest because the client is inviting me into their world. And I think oftentimes that's how I see what it means to travel lightly, is that I'm a guest into their world, into their internal world. And it's not up to me to try to overexert myself and try to bring all this to try to convince them. If I see myself as a guest, then I'm not intruding if I do too much, but I could just be there and be hospitable and be invited in.
Yeah, that's such a massive point. At some point, because it's happening here at some level too. I could be hosting and you're the guest, but if I'm so stuck in my world that this is like my talk and I need you to help make a good point for my talk, that I don't see that you're actually telling vulnerable stories in a very vulnerable way. And I could totally miss that and not hold that at all for you. Yeah. So you're actually inviting me in to care, in a different way, and to listen and to connect, and get me out of the hamster wheel.
And then as I engage with you, you're inviting me into yours. And so I think it just becomes this mutuality. So we continue to move between host and guest.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, when even just going back to the idea of compassion and the definition of compassion, it's not just a sympathy, but it's a desire to alleviate a distress in someone else. And so if we're going to be living out our compassions, we have to understand we're not just playing host. We might invite people into a space, we might create a bunch of different things, whatever it is, but at some point there is that shift where they open up about their distress. And the question is, they're going to start to invite you in, and how are you going to hold that? Are you going to be a good guest?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think oftentimes, especially what we grew up with, especially in the 80s and 90s of evangelism, it's like we go in and I asked a very intrusive question. It's like, do you know if you're going to go to hell today? And it's almost like you go into a house and then you go straight into the bedroom and then say, hey, you need to change your heart. But you don't do that as a guest.
This wallpaper sucks.
It's very intrusive.
Yeah.
You go into the living room. That's what guests do. Mm-hmm. And then you get welcomed in. It's a vulnerable space when someone allows you in. But it's also vulnerable to be a guest because you have to receive the hospitality of the host.
Yeah. Which is one thing I think I struggle with. Like I want to, the reciprocity, I can't just openly receive it. Well, and so I guess this idea of being a good guest as a therapist, I've always felt like this has a lot of connection to outside the counseling office because we have an ethic board above us. And initially I thought that it just was confining and sometimes aggressive, but a lot of it's there to not only protect the client, but to really foster connection. So it's like we have our own set of parameters of how to connect, right? That we don't barter, that we don't meet people at Starbucks. Like, even though some of that would be cool, it's actually there to allow for connection to actually take place. And it sounds like, you're using the words parameter and stuff like that, that there's, it seems like one of the things that Jesus is doing in this text is trying to give us some parameters to our compassion, whatever it is.
Yeah, I think the parameters Jesus was giving the disciples, like shake off the dust, travel lightly. It's a way of like saying, setting the frame. You don't have to do over and beyond. Just bring yourself. I think that's kind of what mm-hmm. I see Jesus asking.
Yeah. Well, and this brings us to the last point, which is in the passage, it says, don't make a scene. Shrug your shoulders and be on your way. You can be sure that on judgment day, they'll be mighty sorry, but it's not a concern of yours now. So another version of scripture says this really beautifully in place of shrug your shoulders, because that kind of is like, whatever. It says, allow your peace to return to you. Right? Is that we often go out in peace. Like when we do that work and we start to travel lightly, it's like there's less and less, I need to do this or I have to do this. And it's like we're really motivated by love and peace. And sometimes stuff doesn't go well, right? And the question is, it's disruptive. And how do we allow that peace to return to us? Psychologist David Whalen talks about married couples. And especially in the Christian culture, we say the two shall become one. And he's not really denying that, but he's saying, we merge as a unit, as a we, but it doesn't mean that we're one, right? Like two people kind of just stop being their own selves. And then now we're just this one glob, right? Like he's like, so you keep your own self, your own personal desires and personality, but we actually create a third. We create a we. And so he says, we have to learn how to merge without fully merging. He says, merge without merging, which I think is really cool. And so when I think about it in this context, I'm wondering about how do we care without caring, right? How do we, in the moment, care, be present, be fully there, give what we can give, but at some point, we have to understand how to differentiate what our role is, to differentiate what our convictions are, and to be able to move on and allow that peace to come. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think caring without caring, we assume parameters are not caring, but parameters are so important to care. As a parent, you're supposed to love and nurture and just like love on your kids. That's a really important part. But you also need to give them structure and consistency and boundaries, because that's also care as well. And when we don't operate in both, then we actually are not caring without boundaries. That happens in the therapeutic realm as well. When I have clients, like our hour is up, and then that's when they start to like open up, and it's just give me 10 more minutes. Our session is up. It feels like it's not caring, yeah. But it also keeps a consistency and a framework so that they know that this is their time. I have a personal story to share of my son Lucas. He loves playing his iPad, electronics, and games, and we try to limit his, you know, electronic time. And so each day is like, well, you get 30 minutes, and that's it. Well, then, you know, he'll be like playing something, and then he'll watch a show, and then when the 30 minutes is up, he's like in the middle of a show. And then it's like there's like 3 minutes left. It's like the cliffhanger. I'm watching, and it's like, wow. So my heart definitely felt cared for him. Like, wow, like I could give him 3 more minutes because it's just 3 more minutes. And it would suck for him to have to like cut it off right there because there's only 3 minutes left. And so I would just give him the 3 minutes, and then the next time he'll ask for 5 minutes and then 10 more minutes. And then it becomes where now he gets angry at me for not letting him finish the show, because last time I let him finish the show and then go over the time. And so it's this constant struggle. And then I get resentful with him because I'm trying to care for him and give him a little extra time. But then now he's angry at me for not giving him more time. So that's kind of where the time limit is actually care. It's just like, that's it, buddy. Maybe you could watch it tomorrow, the last 3 minutes.
Yeah. So the idea of the rule or the parameter is really, it serves as the differentiation point of like, you are caring, you're thinking about him emotionally, developmentally, right. All of those things. But at the same time, there is, and what maybe this is really important because this is a conversation, is because this stuff is like really complicated, because you just told a story before of you were actually caring for your client, but it didn't seem like you were caring. Right. And yet at the same time, let me get this right. See, it's complicating me. That like this care that you can give him, it's going to seem like it isn't care when in fact you really are caring. Yes. So it's just the importance of being able to have, I guess, these conversations, because when we have a disruption, Lucas gets mad, you get resentful, you guys separate. There's that sense of how in the world could we ever have this peace returned to us, right? It's the same thing when you pour so much of your life and your soul into a person or into a project and it doesn't go well. Like whether it's 5 minutes or 5 months, it's like, how do you allow some of that to come back to you? And I feel like it's part of it is just keeping that middle ground, because we can so quickly fall into either apathy and say, I don't care. I don't care about my marriage. I don't care about this thing anymore. I don't care about my job anymore. Or we can just suppress it and deny it and like, no, I'm good. Which, you know, Christian culture can do pretty well. So it's really how to hold some of that middle ground. And the way that I think about that is to ask ourselves, are we being a good guest? Did we honor what they invited us into regardless of the outcome? Did we own our role in it? And can we allow some of that peace to come back to us? Can we be thinking about that opposed to maybe justifying ourselves? And like you said, when we talked about this before, just to kind of wrap up, there's really beautiful examples in our Christian faith of people who have done this well. And there are really bad examples too. And I kind of was in college at that tail end of the apologetics, kind of, if to live out your faith is to evangelize, you know, that's all it meant. And we were pretty forceful. We knocked on the door and we demanded to come in and prove the existence of God and prove how much they needed God. And we never learned about listening or any of that stuff. Like, we never realized that we were stepping into a sacred space and that maybe we need to take off our shoes. We just felt like we were playing the role of host, and this is what we need to do. This is how we can help you. And so it's important to think about this charge that Jesus gives us, to live out our compassion, is to connect with those around you in ways that Jenna talked about, is inclusion, to invite others into those sacred, inefficient spaces and to be good guests with them. So I'm going to finish with one last spiritual practice, which is consider doing one small, humble act to exercise your compassion that will put you in the position of having to be a good guest. Let's end in prayer. Loving Father, we come from you, we are growing up in you, and we are thankful for you. This charge challenges us. May we feel the compassion that resides in our bones. May we have the focus to hone it, the courage to express it, and the resiliency to allow it to return to us. Show us how to value what is small, humble, modest, and everyday. For these somehow are too confining for our egos, but vast enough to carry your love. Help us to appreciate your work in each person and be good guests within those living, breathing, working spaces. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.